From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the United Nations Climate Summit kicked off in Copenhagen. Billed as the biggest environmental meeting in history, the aim of its thousands of delegates is to seal a worldwide deal to head off dangerous global warming. But that was before they had to contend with this.
Tonight, a global investigation into what's being called ClimateGate. Hacked emails that some say call into question the very science behind global warming.
The emails spanning the last decade were written by scientists based at the University of East Anglia's Climatic Research Unit in the UK. In some, they discuss tricks to fudge temperature records. In another, a scientist wishes he could beat up a leading climate change denier. And they also suppressed inconvenient information. This was fuel for the decades-old debate that has been heating up faster than the planet.
Global warming skeptics saying those emails suggest that scientists may have worked together to manipulate global warming data. Defenders say those emails are being used out of context.
Andrew Revkin, environment reporter for the New York Times, himself cited in about 14 of those 1,000 emails as a reporter, not a participant, says the skeptics' conspiracy theories are wrong and that the case for the role we humans play in the warming of the planet is rock solid. However, he says there are legitimate grounds for debate over when or whether we need to prepare for utter catastrophe.
If you are a foe of restrictions on greenhouse gases, you can find plenty of real science out there to support your contention. The rate of sea level rise in this century is still largely undetermined. It could be disastrous. It could be 5 feet. There was just a new study out of Antarctica saying that's entirely plausible, but there's no way to characterize the probability of it. And also, a lot of the understanding of past climate trends relies on data sources that are complicated. There weren't thermometers around hundreds of places around the world before 150 years ago. So you rely on tree rings and temperatures and holes drilled in the Arctic tundra and the temperature of the sea.
And as we shall see, those data sometimes conflict, but let's get to that in a moment. And come now to the question of the emails. How did they become public, and what's the response been?
Well, the University of East Anglia has announced an inquiry into how they became public. They describe this as a criminal breach. There are people who describe it as a heroic whistleblower. What they contain is thousands of, not just emails, but documents, including raw computer code, a programmer's years-long log of his laments of dealing with these confusing data sets, and scientists talking to each other about pending papers. And some of the statements on their face are pretty suspect. Hide the decline, one email said, about someone trying to pull together a graph showing warming that cut out a certain data set because it kind of went the other way. Many of the scientists involved have already posted lengthy explanations on the blog called realclimate.org. But there's still stuff in there for sure that reveals the sort of the ugly underbelly of science.
In one case, scientists put together a graph of temperature trends, and part of the graph derived from tree ring data, and part derived from thermometer measurements, and part was kind of lopped off because it suggested that for one important period, temperatures were going down, not up. Using nominal facts, assembling them artfully to tell a larger lie. Is that not what this graph represents?
I can't make that judgment. No one has dived into the data underlying these graphs, except the peer reviewers when the papers were published. I have to wait for the inquiry to be completed before I can make some kind of determination.
Putting aside outright fraud and fudging data, this email traffic and the logs that you referred to certainly demonstrate that the scientists involved were contemptuous and frustrated by their various critics. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. Many of them, I think, have had this kind of frustration brewing in them for many years. These date from the 90s. I mean, there are some that date from a few weeks ago. So it's a 13-year saga written in emails that they assumed at the time would never be public. And sort of like being John Malkovich, you're inside the brain of the climate science community watching this turbulent era play out.
Your name came up in a whole mess of the material. Tell me how you figured into this.
far as I can tell, my name is either on or in about 14 of these 1,000 or so emails. And to my mind, what's said in them is simply a reporter inquiring of sources about pending papers, about what they think about a competitor's paper. They're the reporting process. And frankly, if I came across any batch of 1,000 emails spanning the period from 1996 to now, and they didn't have my name in them, then I would be worried, because that would mean I'm not really doing my job.
Clearly, you discussed with your editors how you could report on this subject, since you're part of the story.
We disclosed in the stories that I wrote that I was mentioned in some of the emails. You know, we've put it all out there. In these times, transparency is unavoidable. If you're not engaged in an open conversation with the outside world, you're at the very least in peril of being misconstrued. Transparency and the interactivity is a responsibility now. This is just as true for a journalist as for a scientist.
Andy, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
Science writer Andrew Revkin covers climate change for the New York Times.
George Monbiot is a columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian. He's studied the tactics of oil companies and others who have sought to cast doubt on the scientific consensus that we must reckon with the consequences of man-made climate change. And he's especially disheartened by recent polls, like those by the Pew Research Center and Rasmussen Reports, which finds a serious erosion of belief in global warming. To make matters worse, the polls came out even before the leaked emails emerged to further damage the environmentalists' best PR trump card, scientific consensus. Monbiot lamented in a recent column that the hearts and minds battle is being lost, and he says the only hope lies in brutal honesty. George, welcome back to the show.
That's my pleasure.
You wrote a few months back, "There's no point in denying it. We're losing. Climate change denial is spreading like a contagious disease. It exists in a sphere where it cannot be reached by evidence or reasoned argument. Any attempt to draw attention to scientific findings is greeted with furious invective." Can you give me some of the research that backs up the claim that the trend of disbelief is growing?
Yes, there's been a number of opinion polls showing a 20% fall in the number of people just within 2 years who believe that man-made global warming is taking place. And it's now down to 57% in the US, and in the UK down to about 41%. That shift has taken place just as the evidence for man-made climate change has become so firm that it is as strong now as the evidence that smoking causes lung cancer or HIV causes AIDS. And it strikes me that what's going on is that as people are confronted with really the inescapable evidence for climate change, they go into denial in the same way as we might go into denial when we go to the doctor and he says, "I'm sorry to tell you, you've got cancer."
But George, you've gone even further. You postulate that this may be, in fact, generational.
What the surveys all seem to show is the same thing, that it's among people over 60 who are most inclined to disbelieve that man-made climate change is taking place. Now, I think there could be a number of possible reasons for this, but I wonder whether there might not be an element of the sort of denial of climate change being mixed up with the denial of mortality, which does appear to become more extreme as people become older.
You've done a great deal of research into the sorts of public relations campaigns to counter the scientific consensus over climate change in tobacco companies, in oil companies, in other interested parties, and you've seen how it works. Have you seen a way to combat it?
Well, first off, there are some people you're never going to reach.
Right.
There are some people who, when the water is rising round their necks, will still say, "It's all a scam. It's all an attempt to create a communist world government. Don't listen to what they're saying." For those you can reach, the undecided people stuck in the middle, I think there's a number of approaches. First, of course, to keep emphasizing what the science actually says, but maybe perhaps also to tell a story. It's the storytelling which reaches people most effectively. Perhaps the story that has to be told is one which says, you have to decide who you are. You have to decide whether you are one of these people who wants to just stick your fingers in your ears and sing very loudly in order not to hear what's going on. Fine, that's your choice. If that's what you want to do, you go ahead, but you will be kind of left behind by events. Alternatively, you can be the person who wakes up to this before most people do and starts to mobilize the community response that we need, just as countries in the free world mobilized against great threats in the past, for instance, the rise of the Axis powers, and saw them off through sheer determination. We have to do the same today. So you can decide.
So now the climate change conference is underway. We're speaking on Thursday. It has some days to go. How do you think it's going?
It's not going to deliver. And in fact, some people like Jim Hansen, the senior scientist at NASA, are saying that it would be better if the whole thing collapses than if it goes ahead with a weak agreement. It's not a pretty picture at the moment. There's no point in pretending that it is. And, you know, if only people were pursuing some sort of communist world government, they might do it rather more efficiently. I mean, this is a stupid thing, you know. If they are organising a vast conspiracy, for God's sake, just get on with it.
In one of your recent articles, you noted that the response of the Greens and most of the scientists I know is profoundly ironic, as we spend much of our time confronting other people's denial. Pretending that this, meaning the emails, aren't a real crisis isn't going to make it go away.
Well, they've attempted to minimize the importance of the emails, while, of course, the other side, those who deny that climate change is taking place, have attempted to maximize the importance of the emails. And both responses are wrong. You know, the argument I keep making is that it's those of us who have relied and continue to rely on climate science who have the most to lose if that climate science and if the processes behind it aren't completely robust. And I don't approve of this pusillanimous, foot-dragging response by a lot of climate scientists and environmentalists who are saying, oh, just forget it, it's no big deal. We have to ensure that the science cannot be criticized.
George Monbiot is a columnist for The Guardian newspaper in the UK and author of Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. George, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, then.
Coming up, public relations ploys to move the human heart.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's an old saying that one death is a tragedy, a million deaths a statistic. You could call this the first law of public relations, at least when it comes to building support for humanitarian causes. Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times and co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. His book and his columns frequently feature individuals who suffer unspeakable horrors, but do more than suffer. They triumph. That could be the second law of public relations for this most humanitarian of advocacy journalists. Nick, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So you wrote in Outside magazine recently that you had a revelation when it came to covering Darfur in 2004, but it was coming back that opened your eyes to coverage of Pale Mail.
That's right. The same time that I was so frustrated by the lack of response to genocide, I found a cause that New Yorkers really could rally around, and that was the eviction of a red-tailed hawk called Pale Male. The building in which he was living had taken down his nest, and New Yorkers were galvanized, and I was just thinking, you know, if only we could get as much indignation and action to prevent genocide as we could about a homeless red-tailed hawk. And that kind of got me thinking about how one can make that connection.
And so you looked at some recent research about what moves us, information that's a big part of marketing.
Well, I came across social psychologist Cole Slovic, who has done a great deal of work in this area, and the experiments typically involve exposing people to a particular scenario and then seeing if they will contribute. One of the classic experiments involves a 7-year-old girl from the country of Mali who's starving and asking if people will help her out. Everybody wants to help Rokia. But if you ask people to help 21 million hungry people in Africa, nobody particularly wants to help them. Maybe what I found even more depressing is that the moment you even provide more background information to Rokia, if you say that she is hungry because of a famine in her country, then interest in helping her tends to drop. You know, we all know that at some point people tend to get numbed and tune out, but one of the things that I found fascinating was the number at which we tend to tune out. It's not a million, it's not 1,000, it's not even 100, it's 2.
Two. It was just amazing to me to read that. You've got starving little Rokia, you add her starving brother, and people are less likely to support.
That's right. Even though people are very generous in supporting either Rokia or the boy, Musa, the moment you put them together, they're less willing to help just 2 7-year-old kids. And, you know, so the moment we start talking about hundreds of thousands, people's eyes just glaze over.
You've also written that outsiders are far more moved when people are able to triumph over their privations.
Yes, and there is some evidence, although it's not conclusive, that the reason we give is when you help other people and it makes a difference, then, you know, your own brain is flooded with chemicals that make you happier. And so, I mean, one irony is that it's really hard to be truly selfless because the brain derives incredibly selfish pleasures from being selfless. But you get that when you make a real difference and when you feel a part of something happy out there.
How do you finesse a story that might not end happily? Because obviously you're an advocacy journalist. You report not just to report, but to spur action.
Well, I must say I always flinch a little bit when people call me an advocacy journalist. So I'm flinching just a little right now.
This is an honorable tradition, Nick. A. B. You actually list charities in your column. So it isn't as
rub
if you're
in,
a...
Rub it in, I mean, look, there are some things that are just so terrible that, you know, it's really pretty hard to find somebody overcoming it. But one of the things that I have found is that you're more likely to find a hero out in those brothels of Cambodia, you know, than you are here in the streets of New York, because these incredible bouts of inhumanity also tend to bring out the best from other people around them.
So you've been writing that these sorts of rules, an emphasis on individuals rather than groups, not worrying so much about context, putting the spotlight on positive stories, that these are being heeded by companies trying to sell soap more than they are by philanthropic organizations.
You know, at the end of the day, I think humanitarians really feel very awkward and embarrassed about marketing. But it really doesn't matter whether a shampoo gets better marketing. It does matter when a famine or a huge crisis is, well, I hate to use the word marketed better, but, you know, is publicized in a way that will be more effective.
Have you seen a product with no social significance be marketed according to these rules?
Sure. I mean, anytime you see a shampoo, for example, being marketed, it's not based on the fact that, you know, 38% of adults have shinier hair when they use this product. It's about, you know, one particular person who, wow, she looks better and she's going to get a better date or whatever it may be. It's these individual stories that feel kind of empowering and heartwarming. I mean, one of the challenges for me, frankly, is that if you follow this research, then you would leave out context. All you would do would be telling individual stories, and that would be one step too far for me. I do want to connect with people and inform them about these larger problems. So my compromise is that I do try to find a story that will resonate with people, but then at that point I try to throw in the larger context, the background information, make it clear that case of the Congo, for example, that how many millions of people are affected, and hope that doesn't deter the power of that individual story.
Is there any issue that resists this approach?
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. Climate change is one example, because while there appear to be many, many victims of climate change, it's very hard to find a case where you can connect that causality. For example, malaria is going into new areas because of global warming, and so I've gone to those areas in Burundi, for example, and I can find people who are sick or dying of malaria. But with any individual case, you can't be sure that that is connected with climate change.
Now, you have a particular issue, the oppression, the abuse, the murder of women all around the world. That's your focus. Why do you think this is the preeminent issue of this century?
Actually, can I turn the tables and ask you a question? Are there more males or females in the world today? What's your guess?
My guess would be more males.
You know too much, Brooke. Almost everybody you ask says that there are more females, you know, because in the U.S. there are more females, in Europe there are more females, but worldwide there are actually more males, and that is because so many women have been discriminated against to death.
I know that because I read you, Nick.
I can't complain about that. there are somewhere around 100 million women who have vanished because of this kind of discrimination. And that's more than all the men who were killed in all the wars of the 20th century. It's far more than were killed in all the genocides. When you have that kind of oppression, that just feels like a transcendent issue. The other reason to focus on this is if you want to tackle global poverty, terrorism, civil conflict, in fact, all the issues that we're wrestling with in Afghanistan and Pakistan right now, then the most cost-effective way of doing that is to educate girls, to bring them into the labor force. That tends to result in more economic growth and into more civil society.
Before you had your public relations revelation, what do you think is the greatest opportunity that you missed?
Writing about AIDS, I was often frustrated that I'd write about AIDS in Africa, and, you know, it just disappeared into the pond without a ripple. And I think that in retrospect, if I had managed to, alongside all the horrors of people dying young, if I'd found some examples where success is possible, I think that maybe those columns would have had more effect.
You said that you flinch when you get called an advocacy journalist, but when you sit down to write a column, what is it that you're trying to achieve?
Well, I'm advocating, but I'm reluctant to be called out on it. My career was as a reporter, and there's an uncomfortable tension there because one of the reasons that I became a journalist is, frankly, that I wanted to make a difference. And yet, at the same time, there is sometimes a perception that an advocate is somebody who goes out and finds evidence to buttress their pre-existing convictions. And that's why I flinch.
But you can tell the truth and still want to spark a particular action.
Yes, absolutely. That is one of the great perks of journalism, that there are a lot of problems in the world and that we carry a spotlight. What I want to do is shine my light to illuminate that problem. But I don't want to tinker with the evidence. I just want to galvanize people by showing them what is out there.
Nick, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Brooke.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. He's co-author with Cheryl Wu Dunn of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide.
On his first day in office, President Barack Obama promised to bring transparency and openness to the White House and to the whole federal government. But he reneged on his promise to release photos of U.S. soldiers abusing prisoners overseas. The administration invoked the state's secrets privilege to dismiss lawsuits, a practice Obama had criticized during the campaign. And while the president called for the negotiations over health care reform to be televised, those negotiations remain behind closed doors. But on Tuesday, the Obama administration announced its Open Government Directive in hopes of proving that it really is committed to that transparency stuff. It asks government agencies to make all sorts of data public and to build websites devoted to sharing the information. And it calls for a central place on the White House website to rate the openness of each agency. John Wunderlich is policy director at the Sunlight Foundation, and he says this initiative is a big, big deal.
This Open Government Directive is the administration making a real commitment to systemic change within the government. They're saying, what should the American public be able to know about the government, and what's the best way to share that information with them?
Now, we in the press often think of transparency as we have a request for a certain document, we make a FOIA request and eventually get it, and we go, oh, okay, well, we got that. But we're talking about data in just vast, vast quantities. What are these data sets that will be made available to the public?
Well, each top-level agency within 45 days has to make public three high-value data sets. Now, it's a great question as to what constitutes a high-value data set, but what agencies have released so far, even in the few days since the directive was announced, includes a bunch of data sets that we can already say are going to make a difference in how we perceive the government and in how it operates. One example of that is the government puts together each year a report on how well they're responding to Freedom of Information requests. How long does it take them to respond to the requests? How often do they use the excuses that they have for not releasing information? And this information is really valuable to shame agencies that are performing poorly into doing better, and also to give positive reinforcement to agencies that are using the Freedom of Information Act well. And for the first time this week, the Department of Justice released that information in spreadsheets. That's just one example.
Now, that happens to be an example of how government transparency will document government transparency. But there are other vast data sets from every agency of the government that are interesting, even profitable, to people not necessarily in the news business. I'm sure the Department of Transportation has lots of data out there that many parties are salivating to get their hands on.
Yeah. Some information that was released earlier this week from the Treasury, they're releasing what they call migration data, the number of people filing tax returns, the number of exemptions, and all sorts of information that doesn't sound sexy at first. But if you're a marketer or if you're someone who's thinking about where to set up a business or what kind of business to set up, this is the kind of information that allows you to make decisions that will make your business succeed or fail. Over the course of the next year or two, we're going to see a real renaissance of government information. And suddenly, possibly without knowing it, we're going to become empowered by what our government has known but hasn't been sharing very well with everyone else.
Okay, so I want to ask you a slightly technical question, and that has to do with the format for the data. Now, it's one thing to dump a bunch of data on the public and another to make it actually useful.
That's right. Probably the best, most obvious example of that is when the government releases data as a document rather than as a database. So it's not uncommon for reporters to make a Freedom of Information Act request, and then the government will respond to that request by taking what is an enormous spreadsheet, printing it out on individual pieces of paper, scanning that paper, and then taking those scans and sending them on a DVD. So we are like five levels removed from what is useful information. And releasing data as data rather than as a document empowers other people to visualize that information and make charts and comparisons and all sorts of things. And what we're seeing right now is the government committing to a more useful disclosure of that information.
Now, I know everybody there at the Sunlight Foundation, it's like high fives all around. The United States government is finally opening itself up to more public scrutiny, and that's all great. But are there any teeth built into this?
There aren't really specific other provisions like, for example, if you don't meet this deadline, your budget will suffer accordingly, which would probably be the best way to get agencies' attention. There's going to be a lot of negotiation and a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of haggling between the administration officials and officials at each agency who generally tend to be resistant to this kind of change. But I think the level of enforcement that they build into this directive is appropriate. When they're announcing a new, broad, comprehensive initiative like this, they're always free to later back it up with specific enforcement mechanisms.
But it seems to me that the next president could reverse it all, no?
Yeah, that's absolutely a risk. In 2001, the Ashcroft Memorandum reversed longstanding FOIA policy that made the presumption one toward openness. So there's no guarantee of success here. And we are very interested in taking the things that they're doing proactively and codifying them and making it permanent. And I think there are a lot of members of Congress and staffers in Congress that are interested in doing the same. One of the effects, I think, over the next year of all this new information being released is that we're going to see there's a lot of information policy that's going to need to be re-looked at, re-examined, and possibly updated.
As journalists, you know, maybe we'd think of FOIA as the yardstick for how transparent the government is. But what we're discussing here today is exponentially larger than the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, we're talking about huge reservoirs of data.
It makes me think of the difference between a surgeon opening up a small section of the body and saying, ah, there is a tumor here. The difference between that and doing an MRI of the entire body and being able to scan it. We're talking about universal, comprehensive policies that dictate when information should be released. Now, FOIA is not going away anytime soon. We'd love for it to be unnecessary because the government does such a good job of affirmatively disseminating information. But that's a long-term goal. We'd consider it a success if these new policies make even some FOIA requests unnecessary.
Okay, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
John Wunderlich is Policy Director for the Sunlight Foundation, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization in D.C. advocating government transparency.
Coming up, Iran uses Facebook to track critics across the globe and the evolution of the non-resident Indian on the big screen.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in the Iranian capital, Tehran, another wave of student protests against their government and last summer's disputed presidential elections. Also, more violent clashes with police. According to reports, the government fired shots into crowds of protesters, jammed cell phone signals, internet connections, and satellite TV reception, and ordered reporters to stay off the streets of Tehran until Wednesday. Ever since last summer's elections, the Iranian regime has used a heavy hand against dissent inside the country. Now the Wall Street Journal reports on the Iranian government's fight against dissent outside the country as well, essentially going global against the opposition. Farnaz Fasihi is the Deputy Middle East Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Brooke.
You and your reporting team have interviewed more than 90 people around the world who have talked about how they've been pursued and threatened by the Iranian government. You began your piece with a young man who lives in the U.S. and has family in Iran. It began with an ominous email.
The email to Kusha warned him that if he doesn't stop his criticism of the Iranian regime, his family in Iran would be harmed. He first thought that this was a joke, that somebody was playing a prank on him. He's a graduate student. He's not typically a political activist. But he had attended several protests. He had created a petition for human rights activists who was arrested in Iran online. A few days later, I think 2 days later, his mother called from Iran and said that security guards had gone to their house and arrested his father and detained him for a day and warned him that unless his son stops his activity and brings down the petition, he could never return back home safely and that the family would be facing more problems. You know, this is pretty shocking to the diaspora because up until now, they've had a pretty good relationship with the Iranian regime. Many of them go back and forth, and Iran has sort of tried not to disown them. But the June election really just turned the relationship between the Iranians in exile and the regime on its head.
Well, part of the reason, as you note in your piece, is how powerful the Iranian diaspora has been in the past. I mean, in 1979, it had a great deal to do with the revolution.
Absolutely. I mean, these are people who know how this is done. And now with modern technology, it's much easier than it was 30 years ago. Iran announced just last month in November that it was creating an internet crime unit. I mean, the internet has served the Iranian opposition very well to organize and pass information on Facebook and on Twitter. It also has a flip side in which it's allowed the regime to also monitor the activities of opposition supporters online and identify them.
Getting back to the young man who got the threatening email, mm-hmm. from what you could find, is the Iranian government hacking into people's accounts?
I think that in this case, they used the public Facebook page that he had created for the human rights activists. So they could identify who created the petition, who has signed on, and what kind of comments are being put on the page. So it's difficult to determine whether they have actually been hacking into people's private settings, but what we've seen is that many members of the Iranian diaspora have changed their last names into Irani, which simply means Iranian. They've taken their pictures off, any personal information off, and quite a number of people we interviewed temporarily deactivated their accounts when they were going back to Iran.
Can you give me another example of someone who was threatened or whose experience seems to have been shared by many, many dozens of people?
One of the things that we found was very prevalent was people under 30 who were going back to Iran on holiday or for visiting after June who were stopped at the airport and asked to log on to their Facebook accounts. This is from, you know, many examples from different parts of the world confirming this. And one doctor, a physician from Dubai who was going back, said that he lied and he said he doesn't have a Facebook account. And then they Googled his name and found it and took away his passport. So this is something that we found that was quite common.
For the people you interviewed, did the tactics work? Did they feel threatened enough to stop using the sites or stop speaking out altogether?
Some people have been really outraged. They're very angry. They feel that they live in a free democratic society and they've, you know, broken from the chains of dictatorship and they don't want to be told what to do in the U.S. or in Europe or be intimidated. But I have to say that many, many people are also very cautious. You know, we saw quite a bit of people at the protests in September wearing big sunglasses, covering their face, trying not to be identified.
So then, is the Iranian regime being incredibly paranoid or incredibly canny?
I think probably there's truth to both.
Farnaz, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Farnaz Fasihi is the Deputy Middle East Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal.
Every December, the Committee to Protect Journalists compiles a list of reporters, editors, and photographers worldwide who are behind bars for the heinous crime of practicing journalism. Year in, year out, some facts about the list remain the same. For example, for more than a decade now, China has been the number one jailer of journalists. There are, though, some real revelations this year that have everything to do with the changing nature of the news business. CPJ Executive Director Joel Simon joins me to explain. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What were the biggest surprises this year in what your organization calls its prison census?
Well, first of all, we're up this year. We're up about 10%, 136 journalists in jail around the world. The crackdown in Iran is the primary reason. Of the dozens who were rounded up in that crackdown, about 23 remain in jail. The other thing is that half of all journalists in jail around the world now work online. They're bloggers, web-based editors. And the third thing is that we've seen a doubling of the number of freelancers in jail around the world over the last 3 years. In our current census, 60 of the 136 journalists in jail are freelancers.
Let's put some names to the numbers.
Well, let's start with China. A typical example is Hu Jia. He was arrested in response to a number of critical blogs, including one that challenged the Chinese government for its lavish spending on the Olympics while it failed to address social problems. He became very prominent. He was arrested in December 2007 before the Olympics and sentenced April, just a few months before the Olympic Games commenced. In Iran, what we saw there was this massive crackdown after the elections. And in the minds of the government, there was actually a media conspiracy to discredit the elections. And so journalists were part of that. Some of them were accused of being spies. All of the 23 journalists who remain in jail in Iran are Iranian. One of them is Fariba Pajo. She wrote for a number of websites, but she also was a stringer for AFP and wrote for El País in Spain and was one of the journalists providing information to the outside world. Now she's behind bars.
I want to ask you about the internet because it has
widely been discussed now for more than a decade as the means by which democracy could flourish. But you observe in a piece you did in Slate that there's a little paradox here, because the nature of the internet also makes it possible for regimes to shut down a lot of voices in one fell swoop.
That's right. You have to fight for freedom on the internet the same as you need to fight for it everywhere else. The convergence of media online, where you have print and broadcast, well, that provides a very convenient, what I call, information choke point. Governments can simply pull the plug on the internet and the cell network, as the Iranian government has done, as the Chinese government has done, and shut down the media. We've seen that, and I think we're going to see more of it.
All right, so we're talking about China, Uzbekistan, Cuba, Burma, Iran, and so forth. There's another nation on the list that is kind of an eye-opener. It's the United States of America.
Yeah, and what's really shocking is they've been on the list every year since 2001, and most of these journalists who are detained by the U.S. military, sometimes in Iraq, sometimes in Afghanistan, and there was a journalist, of course, held at Guantanamo Bay. This year, there's one journalist on our list who's in U.S. custody, Ibrahim Jassim. He's a freelance photographer for Reuters. He's being held in Iraq. He's been held for well over a year. The Iraqi criminal court declined to prosecute him and asked that he be released. The U.S. military has not complied. Beyond that, we have no information about what the charges are or what the evidence is.
You also, in your Slate piece, talk about the importance of pushing back against censorship. But Joel, I have to ask you, do you think the Burmese generals or Central Asian autocrats or Fidel Castro or the Ayatollah are, sitting there in a lather about the bad publicity they're getting from the Committee to Protect Journalists?
I don't expect them to be in a lather, but, maybe their mourning is not quite as good as it would be otherwise. I mean, look, there are elements within every single one of the governments that you mentioned that care to a greater or lesser extent about what the world thinks about them. And if you look at what's happened in Iran, where there have been some international campaigns to win the release of journalists like Mazhar Bahari, Roxana Saberi, there's no question that that pressure made a difference. You're not going to get these governments to suddenly go, oh my God, the Committee to Protect Journalists has denounced us, we're going to release all our journalists. No, that's not how it works. But it's one small piece of a larger international effort, and I do believe that it makes a difference.
Joel, as always, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be on.
Joel Simon is the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
The depiction of the non-resident Indian, or NRI, in Indian films has always interested WNYC reporter Arun Venugopal. As an NRI growing up in Texas, Venugopal took special note of how the Indian film industry depicted people like him. His first exposure to Indian movies came early in his life, and as he wrote in a Wall Street Journal piece this summer, it wasn't his favorite weekend activity. The films his parents dragged him to see weren't the fun Bollywood flicks now familiar in the West, with catchy musical numbers and colorfully clad dancers. The 10-year-old Arun probably only wishes he could have seen a Bollywood super hit like Disco Dancer. The films Arun saw were slower, more depressing fare from the South Indian state of Kerala. This last scene from the movie Pirava, in which a blind mother weeps after her son has been killed by the police and her husband has had a mental breakdown, gives you a taste. So sad and not especially kid-friendly. And Arun says, to make matters worse,
these are long, long, long movies. They're like three and a half hours long, and film reels would suddenly stop rolling, and you'd have people in the aisles and stuff like that. And you just have this memory of like samosas on the carpet kind of smeared in, and it wasn't very clean.
Among all of the things you didn't like about movie night, maybe the principal one, was the depiction of something called the non-resident Indian, or the NRI.
Exactly. It's this term which is sort of like shorthand for all of us who are out of the homeland, right, all spread across the world. We're seeing ourselves occasionally on this big screen, and there were kind of these caricatures, garish, ridiculously dressed, tennis-outfitted sort of people who sort of talk too much, and we're just kind of excessive in every way, and it's actually your own people, so to speak, who are kind of making fun of you from afar, really.
You cite a 1971 film in your Wall Street Journal piece called Hare Rama, Hare Krishna. You say it's indicative of the snobbish sense of moral superiority that the filmmakers feel about the non-resident Indian living in the West. And there's a famous song in that film that seems to say it all. So let's go to the tape.
As the title suggests, it's about sort of these hippies and how they've kind of co-opted Indian culture. But it's also about this Indian family from Montreal, which is, you know, as Western families tend to do, they're dysfunctional and kind of broken down. There's adultery and deceit going on. The daughter in the family, known as Jasbir as a kid, but now she's become Janice, the westernized kind of, I guess, heroine or whatever in the film. And she's sort of been consumed by the drugs of her hippie subculture, this group that she's in, and they find themselves in Nepal, and she's trying to escape it all. The song is really about this way in which Western culture has co-opted Indian spirituality for its own little cheap thrills. And the song Dum Maro Dum means basically, here, have another puff. And so it's kind of meant to be, I guess, about Indian culture against all those hippie excesses of the 60s.
So we leap ahead from 1971 to the mid-90s, and a film called...
come on, let's do it. Let's hear it.
Dilwale Duniya Le Jayenge.
Perfect. Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge. The lover takes the bride.
This is a turning point film.
It's considered a major, I guess, a milestone in terms of Bollywood's evolution from the India-centric storylines to films which really embrace what's happening all over the world with the Indians anywhere. This film is set in the UK. You have a couple college-age kids. They decide to go on a trip across Europe and they fall in love. But she has a very strict father who would absolutely never allow her to marry some lout that she meets on a trip in Europe. Yet he doesn't want to elope. He wants to win over her family back in Punjab. So they all go to Punjab, and slowly, despite all kinds of hijinks and getting beaten up by her father, he does win her over, and the family realizes, oh my God, yes, they love each other enough.
So here you have the NRI. He's a sympathetic central character, and on top of it, it rakes in a gazillion rupees.
That's right. Suddenly, all these producers back home realize, oh my God, what have we been thinking? Let's make movies about these NRIs, these, you know, expatriate Indians, going between their Indianness and their Westernness.
So after The Lover Takes a Bride, you say that the genre takes another turn.
Yeah, it's in 2004, which I think, you know, one of the more interesting films which came out. It's called Swadesh, which basically means homeland. And Swadesh is about this NASA scientist. He lives in D.C. He feels a little homesick. He goes home, tries to find his old nanny. He finds her in the village. He encounters all these worst aspects of Indian culture. Caste oppression, sexism, illiteracy, all these other kinds of things, poverty. And yet, he really connects with the village, with the people, and with India. Should he return back to the U.S., where he's living a good life, he's well-adjusted, he's not cut off from American society, or should he return to India and try to help the country with some of these problems? Finally, he does decide to go back. So it's somewhat unblinkered in its look at Indian society, its problems, acknowledging at the same time America's not perfect. For the first time, I kind of feel this is where America and India are suddenly attaining sort of a parity.
What changed? Is it because the connection between the Indian diaspora and the Indian homeland became closer?
India's economy really started opening up to the world. They were, I guess, much more conscious of the lifestyles of these people abroad, and they aspired to some of the same sort of things in terms of the house and the car and all those kinds of things, which they, I guess they figured were more attainable by this point back in India. People embraced the Westernness, and this issue of like either or became kind of moot.
And then I guess the ultimate expression of the non-resident Indian would be a film called Tararam Pam, where the cross-cultural experience is no longer the issue.
Yeah, they're kind of post-NRI, you might say. It's not really this division between our identities abroad and our identities back as Indians. It's not a great movie. It's kind of funny. It's about this race car driver who suddenly goes from the top of the world of race car driving in Manhattan.
A race car mecca.
The Manhattan NASCAR scene, legendary as it is. Suddenly he crashes and his life starts falling apart. The family has to move out of their palatial Manhattan estate to oh my God, Jackson Heights in Queens, you know, and there's this scene.
Wow, it's Green Acres.
Yes, exactly. These are the movies that happen a lot nowadays. They don't really obsess over remaining true to their tradition and heritage or whatnot. You really see this global Indian.
Last question. Kumar. Good for the NRI, bad for the NRI.
Great for the NRI. Here you have a movie which is sort of poking fun at that stereotype of the medical student. He can ace his exams and still say, you know what, I don't want it. Let's go get some burgers and smoke some weed.
Arun, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Arun Venugopal is a reporter for WNYC, New York Public Radio.
I would like to introduce you to an invention of mine. Meet the smokeless bong.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hover, Dan Mazzi, and Julia Simon, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.